Indiana. If you don't get exactly what you think is fair and reasonable from my department, give me a call, all that sort of thing. The personal touch, I think, in selling anything is very important. And as a matter of fact, this is one of the things that Mitch Daniels has latched onto. Literally dozens of these prospects who come through Indianapolis for one reason or another have a brief visit to his office. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the selling technique. It's not unusual, for example, for Jeb Bush to call some Indiana companies and tell them how great it is to operate in Florida and so forth. Yes, I mean, that's part of the business. but the Subaru Isuzu thing was a celebrated issue because Indiana had lost out on a previous auto plant, which went to the state of Illinois. We negotiated on that one, lost the deal.
Was that a Honda plant?
No. It was a Chrysler plant. And so there are people who say, well, Mutz can't get the big one done. This was one of those. This is political stuff, but that's the way it is.
Maybe it's like being compared to Peyton Manning.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry.
Well, that's a flattering comparison. At any rate, our office in Japan. See, during my tenure as Lieutenant Governor, we also opened the office in Japan, in Tokyo. We also opened offices in Brussels, later in England. I can't remember. We only had four or five. They have many more representations now than we did then. At any rate, the work that we did there was finally a situation in which Fuji Heavy Industries, which is the parent company of SIA in Lafayette, made it clear that they were going to build a plant someplace in the United States. And they had finally decided there were three states that were ones that seemed location-wise in the right place and so forth. And so the issue was then, you know, can we get that in Indiana? And we showed them sites in a number of locales. they finally decided they liked the Lafayette location best. And I made four trips to Japan involved in that transaction. And I was involved in the actual give and take on the final day when we shook hands and celebrated the new plant and so forth.
What was the nature of that give and take?
Of the what?
Give and take.
Well, the give and take had to do with can you provide us a site free of charge? This was an unusual set of circumstances. And I remember calling from Japan to a lawyer named J.B. King, who at that time was at Baker and Daniels here in town. And J.B. and I had worked together on automobile excise tax back in the legislature, all kinds of things. And he had been an advisor to Otis Bowen and so forth. And I said, J.B., here's the deal. And it's a big deal, about 3,000 employees, we think, et cetera. And I said, is there a way legally to do this? And he said, well, I think so, but I'm not sure. Call me back in 6 hours. And so we did. And he said, I think we can do it. And I said, well, are you prepared to put a team of lawyers on this to get it done? And he said, yes. So that's the first step in this process. Other things we negotiated were training grants, the construction of an interstate highway interchange that directly serves that plant, the widening of the road, which incidentally I may have told you was the Bataan Memorial Highway where we located this thing. This was related to the the criticism that ultimately took place because of the Japanese investment. Those are samples of the negotiation. There is a memorandum of agreement that we signed, which is not legally binding, but what it was is an agreement signed by me on behalf of the state of Indiana that I would use my best efforts to get the legislature to do all the things necessary. And that's kind of what happened. It was a lengthy process. That memorandum of understanding, I think it maybe is probably public records available somewhere.
Were there tax breaks involved in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, tax abatements and things of that kind. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned training grants. These are grants to train workers.
Yes. And then we also set up a special arrangement with the Employment and Training Department that I'm headed to do the preliminary interviews and screening of the thousands of people that applied for these jobs. These were sought-after jobs. You know, they were jobs in the $45,000 to $60,000 range. And they were, we had huge numbers of people who wanted them. And screening 10,000 applicants alone is a big task. So we set up a special system to do that. And but that we did that in other plants as well. You see, there was another big assembly plant that came into being during my tenure, and that was the General Motors truck assembly plant south of Fort Wayne. Now, that's a case where I was forced to work with a Democratic mayor, and arrangements we worked out there were, I think, again, tax abatements and roads, and the same general things were involved. But that was a big new addition, and of course it came at the time that International Harvester was leaving Fort Wayne, and they badly needed this economic shot in the arm. The guy who was mayor of Fort Wayne at that time is now a state legislator, as a matter of fact, in Fort Wayne. No, I'm sorry.
All right.
There, that should be on. Okay.
In terms of the Subaru Isuzu up there in Tippecanoe County, just off of I-65, I assume that one of the attractions must have been the availability of sufficient power to run the plant.
Yeah.
That's a REMC up there, Rural Electric Co-op.
Not exactly.
It's not.
No. What you had was the site that we had picked was a split site, meaning that it was partly served by PSI and part by the REMC. And one of the negotiations that I had to get involved in was to get the REMCs to give up that little piece of territory. And we succeeded in getting that done. It was they were not equipped to provide the kind of power that a plant of this site needs. But of course, they were paid something for their relinquishment of the territory.
I mean, the reason I asked you that question is because, at least in the energy history of the state, there's a long contest between the investor-owned utilities and the rural electric
co-ops
for territory.
That's right.
And so you stepped into that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Somewhat ironic in the sense that later on you became the head of the different version of that power company.
That's right. Well, that's actually the same version. I mean, that was same company. Yeah,
it's still PSI.
Yeah, that's right, and it's still PSI today, although it's a wholly owned sub of Duke Power now. But at any rate, I guess what I'd say is that that's not the only time that we had split territory. This was we worked with the REMC when the territory was all in their jurisdiction. That's a continuing problem in Indiana. Over the years, I have never been a favorite of the REMC advocates. And that was probably another issue in the election campaign of 88, although not nearly as highly profiled as was the xenophobia that I mentioned earlier. The battle with the REMCs, it seems to me, is one of these situations in which, in the early days, it was not economically exciting for the early power developers to wire the countryside. And so this came out of the Roosevelt administration, and it was an effort at bringing power to the country. And it was a great thing for the country. I mean, I remember my own grandmother down near south of Columbus, Indiana. Well, when I would visit down there, when she first got an electric dryer, this was a big deal. We'd had an electric dryer for a long time in Indianapolis. And So we went to Columbus and bought a dryer. I went with her to do this. So, you know, I understand the importance of that. On the other hand, these government involvements like that have a habit of never ending once they accomplish their goal. And I think you could make the case that the energy system would be more efficient if we didn't have this unusual power provider in the middle of the system. The people that run the RMC will give you a far different view, locally owned, locally controlled, investor owned, all that kind of stuff.
In the interest of disclosure, I should probably say for the record that I have done a series of oral history interviews with, excuse me, former PSI folks and with a variety of individuals associated with RMCs, including Mr. Willett Parr, who was the lawyer who put that system together. Uh-huh. I interviewed him the day before he died.
Really?
So just for the record, those interviews exist. And
well, I wondered how you knew this much about it. That was one of there were a long list of items that had to be dealt with during that negotiation. That's one of them. And you're absolutely right.
I read almost every utility commission ruling on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spent 6 months doing research on this before I took up anybody's time. But, I mean, I do know that it was a significant issue, and I was wondering how you negotiated those shoals. As Lieutenant Governor.
Yeah, well, of course, I went to the heads of the utilities and said, you know, this is too good a deal for Indiana. We can't allow this territorial dispute to be a problem. And, of course, I had strong support from the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, and I had the leverage of the governor's office, a lot of things going for me in that situation.
What kind of leadership skills did it take to negotiate deals like that?
Well, I think you have to have some kind of clear idea of where you want to end up before you start the negotiation, and then decide what are you willing to give up in order to get there, and then what is the tolerance level of the legislature for the dollars involved. And you had to think about all those things. And I have to say this, to Bob Orr's credit, he virtually left me alone on that issue. He never got in and tried to, you know, second guess me or say, well, why'd you do this, why'd you do that? He trusted me to do that. I had a lot of advice, a lot of good help from the talented people around me. But the final decision had to be mine, ultimately, as to what we're going to offer and so forth. And you could argue that I could have gotten it for a little less. It might be. But in retrospect now, with what's happened there, I think it was a very good deal for the state of Indiana.
Do you think that one of your skills as a leader is the ability to sell an idea?
Well, I do, and I think if you don't have that ability or at least the willingness to learn how to do it, pretty hard to be in a leadership situation, yeah.
Do you think that your experience in business helped you hone that skill?
Yes, I really do. I mean, when I was in the equipment leasing business, you negotiate every single transaction. You know, it's an interest rate and terms and conditions negotiation. When I would put a new fast food hamburger restaurant in, you go to a prospective landlord and say, I either want to buy your ground or I want to lease your ground, or I want you to build me a building and lease it back to me and so forth. And you then go into a series of negotiations as to what those terms and conditions would be. Now, you always have a lawyer with you to help you on some of these kind of things. But the give and take of those situations does hone your skills, no question.
You established the Corporation for Innovation Development. Can you talk a little bit about what that was?
The Corporation for Innovation Development was designed to create a venture capital network in the state of Indiana. And it's now known as CID Ventures. And what I have to say to you is that once we got through the early stage of this economic development program, with all these tools to get new investors to come to the state and so forth, then it became very clear to me and to Brian Bosworth and Alan Kimball, who were my two main advisors, that we were looking after the short-term interests of the state, but not the long-term interests. And so we decided we needed some initiatives that talked about the future. We knew then that we were going to have a need for more innovation in the state, more entrepreneurial activity, and so forth. So we started three entities to accomplish that goal. One was CID, which was to develop a network of venture capital.
Corporation for Innovation Development.
Well, that's what we called it originally. Right. That's right. The second one was CST, the Corporation for Science and Technology. And that was an entity that received state appropriations and made grants and loans to emerging companies. It also made grants to universities and others who collaborated on research of one kind or another. It is the forerunner of the 20th Century Fund that is currently in existence here in Indiana. And then the third one was called, it may be on your chart there, but it was designed to be a small business assistance operation. And its purpose was to provide counseling and mentoring, if you want to call it that, for small business developers. And we saw all these as essential ingredients in this business of redoing the Indiana economy, because it was becoming, it wasn't clear to most people, but it was in my gut that we had a lot of changing to do in this state. It was very hard right then to get people very alarmed as they are today, because we still had, you know, after the recession was over, this industrial economy came back again.
What do you think was the nature of the changes that needed to take place?
Well, the
what
big,
were the points on the horizon you wanted to march the state towards?
Well, when I saw what happened in the early 1980s with the imprint of the Japanese automobile industry in the United States, it was pretty clear to me that the day of an insulated U.S. economy was over. And what that means, of course, is that as long as you've got other countries that have some ability to do creative thinking, we're no longer the only game in the world economy, that competition is going to happen. And it did. So those efforts were, on the part of our department and our administration, efforts at saying, you know, it's important to be competitive right now on this new investment, but we've got to do some things that shift the Indiana economy. And those were the first steps. Now, there was another one that took place later, and that was the creation of the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. Now, that's the same name, incidentally, as Mitch's corporation mm-hmm. to do this. But we saw that as a master planning operation, thinking about economic plans for the future. What should the Indiana economy look like? Should it be regional? Should it be, how should it be structured? What would be the major building blocks and so forth? And Brian Bosworth became the first president of that operation. And they did some good work. Now, when Evan became governor, he essentially ignored it, and it had a director for a while. What's his name? I think of it in a minute. Anyway, he works for Tom Miller. Did a lot of work on the current economic development plan for the state of Indiana. Those were some of the things. You see, that's another thing about leadership. It seems to me, none of those things would have a great deal of impact during my administration. But it seems to me one of the objects of leadership is to think down the road a little bit and see what kind of lasting impact you can have. So, you know, I don't regret doing those things. I think they were the right things to do.
The Corporation for Innovation Development, you talked about it as a sort of venture capital mm-hmm. network. What was the source of the venture capital?
Well, the initial operation was set up like this. A state-chartered corporation was created, And this state chartered corporation then sold partnership, I think that's right, interests. And I went out and personally solicited individual companies, largely institutional in nature. Now, we raised $9.6 million in this first fund. Then I also recruited the board members. The board members were prominent members of the state business community. Dick Wood, CEO of Eli Lilly and Company. Ian Rowland, CEO of Lincoln Life in Fort Wayne. Dick Rosenthal, CEO of the largest bank in South Bend at that time. John Fisher, CEO of Ball Corporation in Muncie, Indiana. I mean, those are samples of the kind of people that we recruited. And these men, surprisingly, took this on seriously. I mean, they helped sell the rest of the interest in the first fund. They aggressively managed it, and then they hired a professional to run it. And that was what I wanted to happen. Now, the incentive for doing this was a series of tax credits granted by the legislature to the investors in this situation. Now, this was a complicated idea because we wanted also to create other venture funds. And so the same tax credits were made available to them if CID granted to them to these other venture funds.
So Corporation for Science and Technology was one of those other ventures?
No. That's a whole separate entity. A state chartered corporation with state appropriations to support it. But all the money in CID was private money.
Okay.
There was and after the initial phase of its development, it was my intention that it no longer have anything to do with government or politics. I mean, the idea was that venture funds shouldn't be making grants on the basis of political favoritism. It's a decision as to what's a good investment or not. And we also found that the venture capital industry is one which is a networking kind of industry. You make arrangements with other venture firms. They invest in your deals. You invest in their deals. That way you spread the risk and so forth. I guess the intention of the first CID fund was that it be primarily devoted to Indiana companies. But we didn't mandate that in this situation. Now, nearly all of those were, and the first fund was an amazing success. It returned a substantial return on investments. I can't quote the figure exactly, but two or three times the amount invested. And many of the investors had already written off the investment. And I remember Tom Miller at that time, who was chairman of Indiana National Bank, and they put $1 million in, or $800,000, I don't remember, something in that category. And he said, "Johnny, I just came from a board meeting." And I said, "Oh, is that right?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "I had to eat humble pie." He said, "I had to tell the board that we had received a substantial return on the CID investment, and I had asked the board several years earlier to write it off because they thought of it as kind of a civic thing they ought to do to support me and what we were doing, you know." So, you know, this was one of those, this is a risky proposition from that standpoint. But the early going in CID was quite successful. Fund two was as good as fund one, and fund three was successful.
What were some of the investments that stand out?
Boy, I don't know that I can quote them for you. I'd have to get you the CID maintains a complete list of all their investments from the very beginning in all the funds.
Okay.
And you can see them there. But they're not names that you would readily pull out.
You were involved with the State Enterprise Zone program?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's another economic development program that we started. You know, the Enterprise Zones, the Film Commission, the one that's devoted to the development of the downtowns of small towns.
Main Street.
Those are all part of this long list of things that we put in place. And the Enterprise Zone thing was an experiment that I had read about from an economist named Butler, who had written extensively about his experience in the United Kingdom. It was a kind of a, one of those things that conservative economists bandied about as a great idea and so forth. And so I said, well, let's give it a try. And we did in Indiana. Now, with limited success, I'd have to say. The enterprise zones are being phased out now, largely because the tax breaks that we had accreted for them are gone. The inventory tax is going to be eliminated, and so the major revenue source for the enterprise zone commissions would be eliminated.
The inventory tax was the major revenue source for the enterprise zone.
Yeah. The, okay. The deal was that within the zone, industries that operated there got a break on their inventory tax. And then they were originally asked to contribute roughly 10% of that break to the Enterprise Zone Commission, which administered the quality of life issues in the zone.
Infrastructure, roads, that kind of thing.
Well, and also jobs for people and all kinds of other things. Yeah, Enterprise Zone Commissions are nonprofits in Indiana, and they're a lot like neighborhood development corporations.
IntelliNet. What was that?
All right, IntelliNet.
Sounds very high tech, but I.
Yeah, well, IntelliNet was an effort at wiring the state's educational institutions so that they were digitally connected. And I was successful in getting that bill passed on IntelliNet and helped create the first IntelliNet commission, so forth. We got a professor from Purdue on loan to run it for us. Chinese-American, really brilliant guy. And it's the forerunner of the system we have now in place. In other words, part of my feeling here was libraries, for example. We ought to be able to get resources from a library anywhere in Indiana, no matter where it is, and get it in a relatively short period of time. I think it is, you know, the forerunner of the kind of thing that we see now as being taken for granted. How can we expect this state to prosper unless we have broadband available almost all over the state of Indiana, you know?
The Indiana Export Finance Authority, what was the purpose of that organization?
That was to provide financial assistance to companies that sought to export products outside the United States. And our goal there, that's one that Bob Orr really inspired. Bob was always of the opinion that Indiana businesses were too insulated from the rest of the world. They should sell their products outside of the continental United States. And so we devised a whole bunch of things, and that's one of them. Largely, we jawboned it a lot. I mean, it's that kind of thing.
That included agricultural exports?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I just looked at my notes, by the way. Overseas offices representing Indiana in London, Amsterdam, Tokyo, and Taipei.
That's it.
So, mm-hmm. Steve Carter, who is currently the state's attorney general, was on your staff when you were lieutenant governor.
That's right.
What did he do on your staff?
Well, his first assignment was agriculture. He was my agricultural specialist, my liaison to the State Fair Board, my liaison to my Department of Agriculture that I had within the Department of Commerce at that time. Since then, the state's created a separate department. Steve was the one who traveled with me when I was doing ag speeches and things involving that part of my administration, yeah.
Did you play a mentoring role with him as he rose through the
I think so, yeah. See, Steve Carter was introduced to me originally by Keith Buhlin because he introduced me to his parents. His parents were Lake County volunteer politicians in southern Lake County. So when I first ran for state treasurer in 1970, I met the Carters, and they helped me in my campaign up there. And so then, when Steve was getting out of law school and all the rest of it, he became available, and he was one of the people that we added to the staff.
It was a little bit like Mitch Daniels, where Keith Buhlin knew the parents.
Yeah, exactly. And then what happened, of course, was that Steve was one of my brightest and most capable people, and when Mike McDaniel, who was actually my executive assistant as lieutenant governor, what he did was leave the lieutenant governor's office to run my campaigns. and he'd take a leave of absence and spend a year running a campaign. And Steve became my executive assistant when Mike was not there.
Let's see. You also served as Commissioner of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. I understand that you managed a family farm in Bartholomew County.
I did for a long time. My grandmother's lived on that farm till she was 88. That's not right. I guess 90. Anyway, at any rate, we moved her to a retirement facility here in Indianapolis. She died when she was 97. And after she left the farm, it was pretty much left up to me to be responsible for it.
So in your spare time, you managed a large farm?
Well, it wasn't a large farm. About 450 acres, something like that, south of Columbus, Indiana. And we operated the farm on a share basis, meaning that the proceeds of the crops each year are split between the tenant and the owner.
Soybeans and corn?
Soybeans, corn, and some winter wheat. That's right.
What would you consider to be your major accomplishments as Commissioner of Agriculture?
I don't know, it's pretty hard to zero in on any single big accomplishment. I think probably the work we did in the exporting of Indiana corn, and particularly soybeans, may have been the most important breakthrough that took place.
Where were you developing markets? What part of the world did you
Asia. And see, the issue then, and still today, is that soybeans are a major food product in the Orient, and tofu, for example, is a soybean derivative. And soybeans for tofu production are a different kind of soybeans than the traditional soybean that's grown in Indiana. So one of the things that we tried to do is to get some farmers to start thinking about tailoring their product for the export market. Now, there's a lot of that happening today, but we just began that process then. That's an example.
Did you have to eat tofu to promote this?
No. One of the other things I might mention is we did work on specialty products, crops, too. Asparagus, popcorn, things like that.
Did you have anything to do with Orville Redenbacher?
Nothing other than that I met him a couple of times. I attended the popcorn festival in Valparaiso, Indiana, and prayed Marshall several times, and rode with him on a float a couple of times. Nothing other than that.
What was the Hoosier Hay Express?
Well, there was a period of time when there was an enormous drought in the eastern half of the United States, and the hay crop had literally been consumed and deteriorated. And so we organized a major train load of hay that was transferred from Indiana to, I want to say, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And this was a thing that my department organized and got together. We got the railroad to donate the cars, and I actually went down and met with the Democratic governor and delivered the hay and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I'd like to, in the time we have left, begin to talk about your campaign for the governor in 1988. Who were the key members of your campaign staff? Who helped pull it together for you?
Okay, well, clearly Mike McDaniel was one of them. My son was one of them.
Your son's first name?
Mark. Well, his real name is John Mark Mutz, but we call him Mark. He was a lawyer, an associate at Barnes and Thornburg here in town. And he took a leave of absence from Barnes and Thornburg with their blessing, I might say, I think 9 months, and worked on the campaign. And he not only became my best friend in that time period, but stopped being my son and became my colleague, a very important moment in our relationship. The other principals in that campaign would have been Rex Early, who was the head of my fundraising activity. Van Smith of Muncie, Indiana, who was the chairman of the campaign. Those are key players. There were some others.
Who were the people that helped you develop your issues and strategy?
My son, he organized in Bulin fashion a group of young lawyers who were friends of his, and I think there were 21 of them, and each one was responsible for a policy paper. I had the most extensive file of policy papers I think any candidate's ever had. We called them white papers. I don't know what else you, what are you going to call them. They included everything from mental health and mental retardation to highway construction, et cetera. Steve Goldsmith came along as my running mate, and he refined the policy papers on the criminal justice system, on the overcrowding of the prison population, a variety of those things. Yeah.
Later went on to a political career that included mayor of Indianapolis.
Well, he was already mayor then.
Okay, mayor then.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I should have checked the tape before I spoke.
Yeah, uh-huh. He'd been prosecutor,
yeah.
Then mayor, yeah.
And your opponent, of course, was Evan Bayh.
Right.
Who was the son of a well-known senator from the state of Indiana, Birch Bayh. Can you just talk us through the key parts of the campaign?
Well, the campaign was significant for several reasons, in the sense that one of the early traumas in the campaign was something I described for you earlier, was the question as to whether Evan was even eligible to be governor of Indiana. And without any question, the hassle over that originally started by a newspaper reporter who raised it in a column, followed by the court test in which the Indiana Supreme Court was asked to decide, is he eligible or not? Now, in Indiana, there is a section of the Constitution that says you must have been a resident of the state of Indiana for 5 years. And in the normal sense of residency, Evan didn't qualify. But the court found that he was qualified. He, of course, was living with his family in Washington, D.C., and you could make the conclusion that that's the same as living in Indiana if you're a member of Congress. Again, this is one of those situations. The courts have taken a very liberal position on residency requirements. I think I would have been better off in that campaign had that never happened, and that I referred to him as a carpetbagger during the whole time of the campaign and pointed out his lack of experience, et cetera. It took away one of the major issues in the campaign in part, and it gave him an enormous amount of public scrutiny, and he almost looked, during that moment in the history of the whole thing, like a victim. So psychologically and so forth, it's easy in retrospect to say, well, I only wish it had been done a different way. However, that's what happened. And Bob Orr in particular thought it was really important that this determination be made. And I think Bob was speaking from a good government viewpoint. It was not an issue of wanting to rule Evan in or out. He thought it was a determination that ought to be made. And that's the kind of guy Bob Orr was. I mean, I have to give him credit for that. All right, so having said that, I see that as the first piece of the campaign. The second piece of the campaign was that period in which you attempt to get the public to know you. Now, this may come as a surprise to you, but once Evan announced and got into the campaign, I was always behind in every poll that we took during that time period. I never, ever passed him in our polling. even though I was an incumbent lieutenant governor, people didn't understand the difference between Evan and Birch. And there are people to this day who still call him Birch. I mean, that still happens. I mean, Birch Bayh was a very popular United States senator, 3-term, 18 years, lost to Dan Quayle, and presidential aspirant, et cetera, close friend of the Kennedys, actually was in one of the Kennedy plane crashes, pulled Ted Kennedy out of the plane. And I know Birch pretty well. But what I'm trying to say to you is that on the basis of name recognition and other kinds of measures, Evans started out ahead and stayed ahead throughout the campaign. Our tracking in the polling, it showed our closest head-to-head 2 weeks out from the election day. And it was a close election, but we never quite got over the hill, so to speak, in terms of the head-to-head projections. But anyway, the second part of the campaign is this business of get your candidate better known. Mm-hmm. What sort of a human being is he? Not an issue thing, but so we did a lot of television commercials and so forth. We raised $4 million for this campaign, and Evan raised about the same amount of money. And
was that a lot of money?
That was a whale of a lot of money then. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a record breaker from that standpoint. Yeah. now the third part of the campaign was after the state convention, and I should point out that the state convention picked the lieutenant governor nominee at that point. And so we did some polling and tried to decide who would be the most helpful lieutenant governor nominee. And Steve Goldsmith was the one that helped us the most. He also was unbelievably bright and fascinating policy wonk. That's really, Steve is not a warm and fuzzy personality. But there's nobody I know who is a more careful student of policy and willing to try new ideas and so forth. He would have been a great lieutenant governor. We would have had a lot of fun because we would have tried a lot of new things, done a lot of things that I badly thought needed to be done. And we had this whole group of 21 white papers prepared for our action plan. I mean, we were prepared to govern. So the next phase of the campaign was the picking of the lieutenant governor nominees. And you may remember that Evan had, because of his popularity, forced Frank O'Bannon to drop out of the race for governor. And so Evan did a very wise political thing. He asked Frank to be his lieutenant governor, and Frank decided to do it. That was a very wise political decision on his part. That then set the stage for the fall. Now, the fall campaign was full of things involving the xenophobia question that I've raised with you before.
Rated Subaru, Isuzu, and foreign investment.
Foreign investment in general. Paid too much. Gave away the state's money. And they were playing to a clear a problem that we had. It showed up in all of our focus groups. There was animosity on the part of lots of ordinary Hoosiers to this business of, quote, selling out to the Japanese, or as that's how it appeared anyway, or could appear. Also involved at the end of this campaign were accusations involving what would happen to organized labor. One of the things that Evan needed to do, because he was looked upon as a fairly conservative Democrat, was to energize the traditional base of the Democratic Party. And so to do that, he made commitments concerning collective bargaining for public employees and things of that nature. One of the interesting things about this campaign was at one point he even got into a bit of a conversation about whether he wanted to unionize university professors on the college campuses in Indiana. And I frankly did not think that was a good thing for the institutions, and we did run some commercials in opposition to that viewpoint. But at any rate, the fall part of the campaign was built around the kinds of issues I'm talking to you about here.
What were your issues?
Well, let me finish on his. Okay. But underlying everything he was doing was it's time for a change. 20 years of Republican rule, that kind of thing, you know. And the line he used all the time was, you know, John's been a wonderful public servant, and we owe him a lot of gratitude, but it's time for a change, and we can do better. I mean, that's a pretty potent kind of thing. Now, our campaign was built around, quote, first of all, experience. And somehow or another, I was never able to get this point well established. You know, there is hardly a man or a woman in a plant or factory in Indiana who would want the guy working next to him to have just started there. Want somebody who's run that machine before, because it's safety and everything else is coming. And yet, when it comes to government, we have a lot of trouble convincing people that experience is important at all. But anyway, included in our campaign promise was a commitment of no tax increases. And you may recall that at that particular point, the state had a $2 billion surplus. And my view at that point was that given normal economic conditions, even close to normal, that we could manage the state without a major tax increase. We also had positions on economic development, you know, which we thought we already had a pretty good record, and so we were running, quote, on our record. Those are the things that were involved. I have a complete file of the television commercials that we ran at home, and I don't get them out and run them very often. Sometime when I'm very depressed, you know, there's two things I do. I listened to my concession speech after I lost the election, which was more lengthy than most concession speeches. And I said a number of things that I wish I'd said in the campaign. And then secondly, I also rerun the video of my daughter's wedding that was held in the State House. She was actually married on the floor of the State House. We built an altar at one end. It was a beautiful wedding. The only problem was it didn't take. She was divorced 13 months later. And she's since remarried, and it's a wonderful marriage, and she has three children and so forth. But you do have a few of those things that kind of remind you of your of the vicissitudes of your life. I mean, there are times when things go up and sometimes when they go down. You need to find some balance, I think, in that periodically.
To what, you didn't win the election, I'll say, because the tape recorder doesn't know that.
Right, that's
but,
right.
To what do you attribute the outcome when you think back on it?
Well, when I think back on it, I say, first of all, that the decisions that were made concerning the residency issue had an impact. The by name, the by reputation were very strong. Evan is a very attractive candidate. He's a nice-looking guy, has a beautiful wife. And he was a person with about the same amount of money to spend as I had. Unlike previous Republican gubernatorial aspirants, I did not outspend my opponent, and the others all did. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking now from Whitcomb, Bowen, and Orr twice. And Bowen twice. In Indiana, I know we call this a Republican state, and historically it is, but in an election where you have two people who are good candidates and who are reasonably articulate, and you have about the same amount of money, you're going to have a close campaign. And we'll see more of those things happening.
Well, we just saw a reversal of fortune in the last election,
yeah,
too. You talked a little bit about scandals in the State House.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that fit into his claims of time for a change?
We didn't have any great scandals during the Orr years that I would put my finger on. Frankly, he had a bigger problem than we did. Governing the state of Indiana with its, at that time, some 28,000 employees and so forth, it's a ponderous task, and you're going to have some human frailty in this situation.
When we visited during the pre-interview, you described that losing an election after 20 years of public life was a form of grief.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, what I meant by that is that when you have put your heart and soul into an effort to prepare for and to do something, and then it no longer is there, it's no longer available, it's not part of your life, it is removed. That is quite similar in a lot of ways psychologically to when you lose a loved one. And I don't suggest that it's nearly as severe as losing a spouse or particularly a child, which has got to be the hardest one of the losses to bear, I think. But it is a form of grief, and you go through the same process of dealing with that grief that you do when you lose a loved one. And some people do it in a different way, some people take longer than others, and so forth. But I was very fortunate in the sense that 3 months after that happened, Tom Lake came to me and said, I'd like for you to consider being president of Lilly Endowment. And that was an enormous uptick in my life. I said that was a turning point in my life, no question about it.
And that may actually be a good time for us to say thank you, because I know that you have an appointment.
I do, and I'm going to have to move on
here. Thank you very much, and we'll look forward to seeing you one final time.